Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 16, Episode 12. This week, we heard Bob break down and discuss Ivan Bates' recent decision to withdraw the motion to vacate Adnan's conviction. We are sans Janet today, but Bob and I are here to answer all your listener questions. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
No, nothing off the top of my head other than, let me see, what's the timing of this? Yeah, before you guys hear another follow-up, we're looking at next Wednesday will be the first episodes of the Underestimated podcast. My students podcast should be dropping.
How many are dropping at once? How many are they dropping at once?
I think we're going to drop two at once. So the way we're going to do it, because there was a lot of, we're trying to figure out, right? Because there's five groups. They all have three episodes that they're working on right now. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to let each group like drop three. So the group that's doing the Skelton Brothers case, which is actually in the news right now, they're going to drop their first three. And the idea is they'll drop them once a week. And then another group will drop three, so on and so forth. But I think we're going to drop two on the first day, partially just because it helps with their like iTunes chart visibility and all that stuff when you drop two a day. But also that group has like, which is their first experience doing this, right? They wrote their script and everything. And I'm like juggling around with everybody. And then was it last week? They're like, Mr. Ruff, we're done with the edit. The base edit, you know, where they're ready to put in like the drop in clips and music and all that other stuff. And they're like, it's 8 minutes long. I'm like, Oh no. That's not long enough.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean it's 8 minutes long? We were shooting for 30 for each episode. So yeah, we're hoping that everything still goes off without a hitch. Cause right now they're kind of scrambling. They're pulling audio from the trial that's going on right now in that case, to put some of that in, and they're recording, they're doing like, I had them do like a round table for the end. So like after they're done with the scripted part where they like sit around and kind of like unpack what they talked about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
be a fun process.
Yeah. So just so you guys know, those first, now the second group that's going to go, their episodes are much longer than that, but they're also still working on them. They're still working on getting put together. Everybody has fully recorded everything and they're now in the edit process. We actually have, the student that made the intro song and gave us a few tracks, she is like, this is band festival time of year. She's been, so there's like solo and ensemble and festival and all these different things that they're doing.
So she's busy.
She's super busy because we needed like a bunch of scoring tracks. And she came to me the other day and she was like, I don't think I am going to have time to get this done in time for you guys to do it. So I tapped the old, our old good buddy Shane Yoder. Is kind of taking inspiration from what she put together for, so her work will be the theme, the intro, and then Shane's put together a bunch of scoring tracks for us. Nice. So that we have that.
Good old Shane.
Yep. Shane's always there for us.
Yeah.
So yeah. So on Wednesday, guys, make sure that you tune into that. I need to get with some of my true crime buddies and see if they can throw a little shout out.
Speaking of scoring, this is way off topic and into the weeds. There's a documentary about Hans Zimmer on Netflix. That's like, he scores movies. Phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Absolutely phenomenal.
Well, that's good to know.
I know. You should watch it.
Never heard it before in my whole life.
I know. I just thought about it when you were talking about scoring an episode. So
yeah. Well, yeah, there you go. There was a documentary for you to watch. You guys might notice we don't have a lot of questions this week and we don't have Janet. This is the real kicker about this. 2 weeks ago, we covered Delphi.
Yeah.
Which is a case that Zach is like deeply entrenched in. And Zach was gone that day. And then this week we covered Adnan's case, which Janet is deeply entrenched in. And she's gone this week out on assignment.
Yeah, it didn't fall the best.
Yeah, if you guys could have just flip-flopped that, it would have been great. But that being said, I do want to, I guess we didn't kind of pick your brain about that last week, but I am curious what are your thoughts about, as far as the Delphi stuff, the big thing is you've been deep into the trenches in all the Delphi groups, mm-hmm. and where all these discussions are happening, stuff that I haven't ever been privy to. What do you think about Ron Logan as a suspect?
After seeing what was put out by the defense in this motion, it is very compelling. And Ron Logan's always been a weird suspect or a weird player in this case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was, they kind of questioned him right away. They knew that his alibi was bullshit right away.
Right.
And then he just like seemingly got cleared, but we never really knew why. And I think at some point you said it maybe in the episode, but you talked about that the FBI never really cleared him, but then the Delphi police, local police kind of booted FBI and just kind of moved past Ron Logan.
And I'm just kind of speculating because I have yet to see anybody show me how he was cleared.
Yeah.
And that was one thing. So what I kind of went back to the source documents that we were talking about, you know, the source documents that were noted or talked about in the defense motion. And it was this is the weird thing, right? So we find the FBI's probable cause affidavit to get the search warrant for Logan's property. And in that, it says that their analysts analyzed the video and they determined that the body type of the person in the video matched the body type or was similar to the body type of Ron Logan.
Yeah.
What I hadn't thought about then, that I thought when we were kind of just chatting about this a little bit earlier, was that's pretty significant. So because, you know, the reaction that we got was people, you know, on, you know, reply guys all saying, well, no, that can't be, you know, there's no way that's Logan. That guy's short.
Yeah.
But I'm like, is he though?
Boy, I saw a photo posted the other day in one of the groups of Ron Logan with the mustache. And I'll tell you what, he looked very similar to
you can see it. Guy. Yeah.
So there's way more compelling to me to be able to see Ron Logan as Bridge Guy than Richard Allen as Bridge Guy.
Yeah. But that's the weird kind of trick of the mind, right? So the response to that was that can't be Ron Logan because Bridge Guy is short.
Mm-hmm.
But like based on what? What are you basing that on? What I'm talking about on is the fact that the FBI analyzed it and said that it was a similar build enough so that they thought that they should get a search warrant. They found him as a likely suspect,
mm-hmm.
the FBI did, to Ron Logan. But the part I hadn't considered until kind of today is if the FBI analyzed that video and determined that the person in that video was a similar build to Ron Logan, who's what, 6'3"?
I don't know exactly. He was taller though.
He's tall.
Yeah, at least six.
Yeah, over six. I think it was like 6'2 or 6'3". But what I'm reading is the FBI is saying the guy on the bridge
mm-hmm.
is over 6 foot tall. So then how do we then now say that guy on the bridge is Richard Allen, who's short? Was he 5'8"? Was he something? I'm throwing out numbers.
I thought he was like 5'4" or something, really short.
He's very short.
Yeah.
Certainly not well over 6 foot tall. So,
and I used to know, truthfully, I used to know all these numbers and I can't remember off the top of my head, but I want to say he was really short.
Yeah, he definitely was really short. I don't remember what the exact measurement is, but yeah, that was like, I don't know, that that just like jumped out to me as like, how is that not a problem?
Mm-hmm.
Like what the FBI is saying is they believed after analyzing that video that the person in the video is over 6 foot tall. But then also then the state police investigators say the person in that video is Richard Allen, who's not over 6 foot tall.
Yeah.
Much shorter than that. So yeah, I found that compelling. One other thing that we didn't mention was I believe there was, do you recall in your kind of like reading about him and the discussions about him? I thought back to it later. Somebody made a comment on Facebook that in the probable cause affidavit, the FBI too, didn't they say that his phone was pinging in the area where the bodies were found?
So I do vaguely remember something about that, but that was also his property.
Right.
So, I mean, and how close can they actually get a ping? You know what I mean? How far dialed in can they get that? I guess I don't fully know.
Well, and that's what I don't know. It depends on, because like all we have is like this, we don't have like the data, right?
Yeah.
We just have this base document explaining it. So there's a difference between what we all keep calling pings aren't pings, like where we're talking about cell tower locations, like in Adnan's case.
Yeah.
Like that's just cell tower connections. Same thing in the Pinion Pines case. So you're saying, we're saying they were connected to this tower at this time.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the same as a ping where they are, in that case, they're triangulating. So it's like they're able to, you know, between three tower. But I don't think that it's, I don't think that's probably accurate with him either, because I think that has to be done in real time.
Yeah.
To like ping three towers to see which one he's close, so you can triangulate the position. So I'm guessing it's, if what it is he was connected to a tower that covered the crime scene area,
mm-hmm.
that we've done enough cases in enough of these towers to know that that just means he could have been within like a 3 mile radius around wherever that tower was. It could have been anywhere, and you can narrow that down by a sector, but even with that,
I've always thought that, and again, just my opinion, I've always thought whoever was connected to this case was familiar with that area and probably lived right there. So when it did come out as Richard Allen, I was a little, I mean, I know Richard Allen lives not far from there, but I always assumed it was one of those properties that kind of butted up to that area.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's Ron Logan, there is the Brad Weber, or the Brad Weber character.
Yeah.
There's another character, I cannot remember his name, and he was never really looked at as a suspect, but his property was just south of that area, and he had a violent tendency, and they kind of looked at him for a minute. So I always kind of thought that it would be more a person like that would have access and means to get there at a way that you couldn't just get there from the public. Like,
right.
You know, you couldn't just park in a parking lot and walk in.
Yeah, and walk past. And I always thought that was kind of crazy too, that like the idea of parked where they're saying that Richard Allen parked, walk through all the trails, past all the people, over the bridge, which is like you're fully exposed on that bridge to go kill him, and then just get back up and walk all the way back, or go out on the road and have to make this long walk on the road. It seems, mm-hmm. of course, if it wasn't planned. I do see, and I'll give a second to see if she catches up in the chat, but Lynn says in the chat that Bridge Guy Analyst said that height would be plus or minus 4 feet. That can't be what you meant.
She probably means 4 inches.
4 inches, plus or minus 4 inches from what, though? And also, like, what's the... Here's the problem with any of these experts that we have come in. Like, they're not supposed to be swayed by the side they're brought in for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're supposed to be neutral and just laying out science. But if, and somebody also said, Mandy said in the chat that you were right, Zach, that Richard Allen is 5'4". So there's a 12 inch or what would that be? I believe Ron Logan is 6'3". So that's an 11 inch difference in height between the two. So like, I don't know where they're saying, like if they say it's 5'8" plus or minus 4 inches, then that would include Richard Allen, but it wouldn't include Ron Logan. So there's some expert that the state found, that the state put up, that said that. But then I go back to the FBI analyst said that it fit Ron Logan, who's 6'3". So mm-hmm. there's clearly a difference in opinion there. So Lynn says that she did mean 4 inches in the estimate. Bridge Guy was a speck in the background of the original video. Lynn, do you know where you're saying that the analyst estimate would be plus or minus 4 inches? Like plus or minus 4 inches from what, though? Like from what is the base point they're going from? Because in order for that to include Richard Allen, that would mean it has to be 5'8" or under in order for him to catch into that 8 inch or that 4 inch window. So I don't know. We don't need to kind of fully litigate this thing all over again, but I just, getting back to what you were saying about them clearing him, you know, what we were talking about earlier is what seems likely to me is that he never was cleared,
mm-hmm.
because the probable cause affidavit, the team that suspected him, that listed all these reasons why they thought he was a suspect, was the FBI. But then, you know, he dies, obviously, in the, you know, throughout the pandemic. And then the state kicks the FBI off the case, and then they go forward with Richard Allen. It makes you wonder if it's not because, you know, that the FBI was still saying, well, we think this guy is a better suspect. And they're like, well, then we already got our suspect, so you guys can go now.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to hear, you know, so maybe like he never was cleared. in the FBI's, you know, it's possible in the FBI's mind, they still thought he was a suspect and never did clear him. But the state already had their eyes set on somebody else and said, well, we don't care what the FBI, we're just going to get rid of the FBI. We don't need your help anymore because we think we've already got it figured out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Well, and I think part of the other thing that I don't want to say led them to clearing him, but I think there was that notion that you're like, ah, he's a 70-year-old man. He's 70 plus. I think he was 77 when he passed, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that was another note. They're like, he's a 70-year-old man. He couldn't have physically been able to do this.
Yeah.
Regardless of what they actually think or know. But like, I think that was something that really helped them or led them to that decision as well.
Yeah. So what was the, I'm curious, even prior to this motion coming out, like in those like forums that you were in, What was the discussion around? Like, are there a lot of people out there that were still thinking that he was a solid suspect, or had he been kind of brushed aside by most of the people that were like deeply entrenched in the case?
I feel like at the point that they brought out Richard Allen, he got completely brushed aside because then everybody was on. Even if Richard Allen is the guy or not, but that was the sole focus for the last 3 years.
Well, yeah, because when they arrested him, we were all like, "They got him! We finally did it! We finally caught the guy!" It wasn't until like. You start funny, you know, like Lynn mentioned here that, you know, when the FBI searches house, they didn't find any evidence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's on that same token. Now it was years later, but they also didn't find any evidence of Richard Allen's house.
Yeah.
You know, the best they got was that gun casing, which we've gone over again many times how ridiculous that was. But also like I think even Logan's house, they searched it, a month later?
I believe so. That sounds about right.
It was definitely weeks, if not a month later.
Yeah, it wasn't right away.
And I believe they didn't search any of the outbuildings either. I believe it was just his house they were searching for evidence, if my memory is accurate. Yeah, and Lynn said it searched him early, but it wasn't early. It wasn't the next day. It was quite a while after that. I think it was well into March, I believe, when that search happened.
Yeah, I can't find a date off the top. But I believe you're right. I think it was at least a month later.
All right. So in any case, and I just wanted to, because you weren't here when we talked about that, and I know, is there anything else that you remember from that's worth breaking down?
I know another big part of that was the cell phone stuff, but I don't really, you have the defense saying that headphones were plugged in and the prosecution saying it could have been mud or debris.
Yeah.
I don't see the headphones being a plausibility. I mean, I get why they're trying to throw it out there, but it doesn't make any sense. Why would If the killer did have the phone, why is he plugging headphones into a phone.
Right.
At 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is. You know, just didn't seem very plausible.
Yeah. And I think there's too much gray area there. Because again, to be consistent, it's exactly what I said about the expert. I won't go so far as to say you can always find an expert to give you the opinion you're looking for, mm-hmm. but it's pretty close to that.
Yeah.
Like if that wasn't the case, like you wouldn't have in so many trials, the defense put on an expert that says one thing and the prosecution put on an expert to counter what they said. Like if it's science and it's fact and there's no wiggle room, then you wouldn't have opposing experts like that. So like the state or the defense has an expert that says that no, that whatever that reading was could not be anything other that could not be from water or dirt. It had to have been from something being plugged into it. That's super compelling because mm-hmm. like that means I would mean obviously somebody was there messing with the phone at that time. But at the same time, you know, you've got, well, I guess the state didn't have an expert say it. They just kind of Googled it. But yeah, I don't know. All that stuff just gets too, it's too squishy.
Yeah.
You know, for me to like, it's like the thing with like the camera and the timing and the stuff is off. Like all that stuff is just very squishy. The stuff about, you know, Logan being, and again, even the stuff with Logan being a suspect, like whether or not that should have been allowed, like it's going to be a weird legal argument. I'm just wondering from a practical and factual standpoint, like, is he a legitimate suspect?
Mm-hmm.
I think from what I've seen, and it's because I just haven't seen how he was clear. So they could come out tomorrow and here's the document. This is how he was cleared. We know 100% he didn't do it. I'm like, okay, cool. Then that's not involved. But I haven't seen that. All I've seen is the evidence that makes him look like a pretty damn good suspect.
It sure looks like he should have been looked into more, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. And that's the thing, is this whole case was botched from the very beginning. I do also want to point out, too, and we're going to move off of this, for the people that, you know, have not so much on the show, but like through like social media posts and stuff, it had been like, well, you need to find somebody besides Mata. You need to get somebody on the prosecution side to come on. I just want to point out that, you know, I had mentioned that I had reached out to the Murder Sheet podcast. And then, I don't know, after that came out, Kevin, one of the hosts, like joined our fan page. It was the weirdest thing. Like, I don't know this guy. Like, I don't know him at all. I've listened to some of their episodes just to get stuff from the, you know, I don't have any beef with them. I don't have any, like, I don't know him. He like popped in and was like, made this whole long comment about how he had sent Janet a thing, which Janet talked about on the show, like about liking her comedy or whatever. And she knows me and you know, we never heard from you. And I just responded and said, well, I believe it was like through an Instagram, but it was months ago that I'd asked. But now that I have you here, I would absolutely love to have you on the show. Would you guys want to come on? I'd love to hear your perspective. And then ghosted me after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody else mentioned in another thread, they're like, you really need to have the Murder Sheet on. So now that he was in the group, I tagged him again and was like, here's your open invitation. So I mean, the receipts are there for anybody. I mean, like, I don't know them. I don't have any problem with them. I don't give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, they were somebody that was in the courtroom that has a different perspective. I would have loved to have them on the show. So just so you guys know, it's right out there in the public Facebook group of me. Like, I've made the efforts I can make. I'm done making efforts. If they want to come on, they can come on. But it has nothing to do with me not wanting the other side to come on and explain things. I've tried. All right. So with that, we'll move on to this week's episode. I know this is in the, you know, this we covered this case long before you got involved. Obviously, you went through the reply brief, so you've gotten, you know, you're familiar with some of the Adnan case. What did you think of that episode?
So for me, I really appreciated the way you broke it down and the way you took kind of your stance on the case and just threw it out the window. Mm-hmm. You're like, I'm not putting any of my spin on this. I'm not putting any of my preconceived notions on this. I'm just going off of what is said in this document.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that because I think that was a great way to look at it. I think if you are correct and that Ivan Bates is putting this out with proper intention, he's doing what he has to do legally.
Right.
He's doing his job correctly, which is a huge thing.
Yeah.
Right? If so many of these prosecutors would do their job correctly, we may not have as much of this.
Yeah.
So by him going through these stops and going through these steps and trying to do his job correctly and say, you know, this is not a good reason because of X, Y, and Z, I can appreciate that.
Yeah. And I don't know if there's questions about this. I know you say only we got a couple, like 4 or 5 questions, but I do want to point out like putting more thought into it. Cause the thing is like, I don't think I have to tell any of you, our listeners, that I 100% believe Adnan's innocent, and I'm devastated by the fact that that he's potentially going back to prison, but as of now, the conviction is now reinstated, and as there's no actions in place to try to overturn it. Like, that breaks my heart. I'm devastated by that. I 100% believe he's innocent, but trying to be like, look at it objectively, a couple things. One thing that you got to look at is, and here's the thing. I've been working in the wrongful conviction space for a decade now. I've worked with innocence projects all over the country. I've worked with all kinds of attorneys. I've read a million appeals, transcripts, and rulings, and I know what works and what doesn't work. I know when something's going to get shot down very easily. And kind of the way I looked at it is, if the defense had filed this motion to vacate, like a normal thing, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a prosecutor that's going to be arguing against it, and a defense attorney brought this argument in front of a judge, there's no fucking way that the conviction would be overturned. And so I have to, trying to be as fair as possible, I have to admit to myself that Bates, as much as I hate it, I don't think was wrong here. It sucks, but I don't think he's wrong here. It was weak. It would have been picked apart in a second by anybody. And this is the part that I didn't talk about, because a lot of people, and I'm sure we have people making comments or questions about this, were like, they disagree with me that Bates was kind of doing what he has to do. They're like, no, he really thinks Adnan's guilty. He really thinks Adnan's guilty because he said, he's keeps saying over and over again, like in the long form, the 88 page version, not the executive summary, like he says repeatedly, like the jury got it right. The verdict was correct, and justice was served. And then in like speeches he gave afterward, where he keeps saying that, no, the jury got it right. Would you try it again? Yes, I would try it again. Well, first of all, as I said, he has to say that, but there is also a distinction in what he's saying. Like, I'm trying to like pick apart like where he's actually at with this. And I don't know, I could be fucking wrong. I don't know. But from what I'm seeing and I'm reading and I'm hearing, what I keep hearing him saying is the jury got it right. What I don't hear him saying is Adnan killed Hay. And there's a distinct difference between those two statements. The jury got it right. And of course, like, the guilty crowd's all over this. Like, see, even Bates, you said he was innocent, is now saying he's guilty. I don't think that's what Bates is saying. Bates is saying that the jury got it right, meaning with the evidence they had presented in front of them at trial, they had the right verdict. Now, we know that after trial, that there's a whole lot more evidence. There's a lot better analysis that can be done. There's the trial was not handled well by Christina Gutierrez. But at the trial, when he says the jury got it right, what he's saying is by the evidence that was presented at trial, the jury got it right. And as I mentioned in the episode, he can't, once he's taken that stance as the prosecutor, he can't come out and say, well, I'm withdrawing my motion to vacate, but it's a damn shame because he's actually innocent. Because that statement will get used against, like, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. He absolutely cannot do that. He can't make that statement. If he's removing this motion to vacate and putting it back on the defense to file their own motion to vacate, he can't stand up and say, by the way, he's innocent. And saying the jury got it right is not the same thing as saying that he killed Hay. But also, then I start thinking, like, why? And I truly think if we're trying to, like, why? Because that did somebody ask, like, why I think he flip-flopped? I didn't even look. I didn't have time.
I do not think so.
So good. So I'll just answer that for you. Why did he flip? Because we know, like, when Bates was on the documentary, things he said leading up to this point, he said that he believes Adnan's innocent. He wants a conviction overturned, yada, yada, yada. And now all of a sudden it's the jury got it right and he's withdrawing the motion to vacate. I think the key factor here that nobody's really thinking about was that the Maryland Supreme Court, when they remanded the case back down to be done again, they changed the judge. And that, I think, is what caused this. I think that, so the original judge took this motion and approved it, rubber stamped it, motion to vacate granted, right? If the Maryland Supreme Court said, we're going to remand this back, this time you have to give more notice for the victim's family to be there, I think Ivan Bates goes right back into court, does a redo, they give Young Lee his time, and then the judge rubber stamps it again. But when they remanded it back, they put in a new judge. So now you have a different judge that is going to scrutinize the motion. this new judge is not going to just agree with what gets thrown in front of him and approve this motion. So Ivan Bates is going to have to actually argue it. And that puts him in a pretty precarious position. He just got elected to this office. His career, his reputation is on the line. There's certainly politics that play in here. So I don't think that looks good for him, for him to say, I want to vacate this conviction, and then the judge to turn around and pick it apart and deny a prosecutor's motion to vacate the conviction based on all the reasons he explained there. So I just think that's something worth considering and thinking about, is the fact that the change in judge definitely had an effect on this. At least I think that it did, because he knew that he had a judge that he was going to have to actually make this case for. And I think what happened was he looked into it and found out that the case wasn't strong. Like the case to, on legal terms, to overturn this conviction, it wasn't going to be enough.
Yeah.
So that's just something to think about. Think about the fact that the judge changed, and I think that also changed kind of the outcome of this.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
So this first question is from Michael, and he's got a little statement here. It says, I appreciated Bob's review of Bates' executive summary, but I gather there is another Bates document that was released, a full report. I have not read it, but the way the Reddit guilters are acting, it makes me think Bates has acted a lot shadier than Bob suggested on the podcast. I'm wondering if you've seen this document and have any thoughts on it.
Yeah, that's the 88-page version of the document that I'm talking about. And again, what they're latching on to is Bates repeatedly saying that the jury got it right. And they're taking that to mean that Bates thinks that Adnan is guilty. And maybe that, listen, I'm not a mind reader. Neither are the people on Reddit. Neither are any of you. I don't know what he's thinking. I'm just trying to do my best to try to make sense of what's going on. And I think that if he truly thought Adnan was guilty, we would have seen language similar to what we saw from those Maryland Supreme Court justices. That he would have said he's a brutal, heartless killer that murdered this young woman, and like, that's not the kind of language that we see in there. I think that I just truly think that once he was to the point where he was withdrawing the motion to vacate, and as he said in the executive summary, returning this to a normal adversarial process where the defense files the motion and the prosecutor either fights it or joins it, in that position, he has to present a maintaining of the integrity of the conviction unless the defense is able to prove that there wasn't integrity in the conviction. I truly don't think that he has a choice there. You know, think of a defense attorney defending a client that they know is guilty. Kind of the flip-flop of this, right? They're not doing press conferences saying, well, he's guilty, but I'm going to try to get him off.
Yeah.
They're doing press conferences trying to convince people that he's innocent. They're trying to put up the best defense. They have to maintain that posturing in order for the system to flow the way that our broken system is designed to flow.
So this next one is from Richard. It's actually just a minor correction. It says, you made a mistake saying that it's the state that appealed to vacate Adnan's conviction. That was Young Lee who appealed it.
Yeah. I mean, I think I said in the episode that it was based on Young Lee. I say the state because I think it was the state. Mm-hmm. I mean, on paper, it was Young Lee and his attorney pushing to have the appeal done. But it seemed very much to me. I mean, listen, for those of you that were listening to that hearing back when it happened, when you got to hear Young Lee, when he zoomed in to the hearing and got to hear what he said, I did not get the impression from that he was felt that he was slighted, that he, I mean, so kind of summarizing what he said, he said he felt hurt. He felt like the prosecution was on his side and he felt betrayed by that. But then he followed it up with saying, but if Adnan, and I'm paraphrasing, but essentially, if Adnan didn't do this, then I don't think he should be in jail, and I think we should find the person that did. I just didn't get the impression from him that he's like, no, I'm so pissed off about this that I'm going to continue fighting this all the way up to the Maryland Supreme Court. I personally think that even though the motion, you know, it appeared as though it came from him, I really think that, and it's just my opinion, I just really think that it was the Attorney General's office that were butthurt over this whole thing that were pushing him to do so.
So Kathy has a follow-up question based around this, and it says, why does the victim's family have a standing in the matter? I don't love the way Mosby handled this, but why does Lee get to go to court and participate like this?
That's a good question. That's why I think it was a very dangerous and stupid ruling by the Maryland Supreme Court. I mean, here's me, Fireman Bob, on a podcast telling, you know, Supreme Court justices that they did something stupid. So what do I know? But but the thing is, when you go up to that high and up to that highest level of a court through an appeals process, now you're establishing precedent. And I don't think it's a good precedent. The precedent they established was that in any appeals ruling that happens throughout the state of Maryland, the victim's family now does have a say. Like they shouldn't. Like that becomes the law of the land. The way I understand it now is that you have to give so much notice to the victim's family. They have to have a right to speak. They have to have a right to do this. But the thing is, the case is supposed to be decided based solely on the evidence presented. Yeah. Like, victims' families are given a right to speak, but it is not supposed to influence the outcome. Like a judge has never written an order that says, I'm denying the motion to vacate this conviction, even though this, and this evidence presented this way, the victim's brother made a compelling enough argument in his plea to the court that I'm not going to overturn the conviction. That's not a thing.
And isn't the victim statement typically at sentencing?
In a trial, but this is for a motion like this, usually they'll just give them an opportunity to speak. Like, okay, do you have, you know, when they're doing a motion to vacate, the victim's families will get, they'll oftentimes give them, and I don't even know if in all states if this is a thing, but I've seen where they'll give them the right, like, do you have anything that you want to say on the matter? And they're able to speak their mind, but it is not supposed to influence. It's not intended to influence. The judge has to rule on the evidence and the law, not on the emotional pleadings of the victim's family. It's just like an opportunity to put your thoughts on the record, really, is what it's supposed to be. But because of the Supreme Court of Maryland ruling, now that's the law of the land in Maryland.
Oof.
Yeah. And I don't think, well beyond Adnan's case, that is going to, it's going to change the way things are done in Maryland. And I don't think for the better. Not that, and again, it's not that I don't think that victims' families' voices should be heard, but I don't think they should be influencing the case, because it doesn't. I think back to this example, the West Memphis 3 case. When I spent a whole day, besides where you guys saw interview on the podcast, I spent a whole day with Ryan Clark, who is Chris Byers' brother, talking to him. And it was the weirdest thing, because Ryan was, I don't know if he still is, but he certainly was at the time, convinced that John Mark Byers, who was his stepdad, who was Christopher's adopted father, is the one who murdered those boys. Convinced of it.
Mm-hmm.
The whole time we're driving around, we went to the cemetery. We did something. He's just telling me, yeah, I went there and he had, there was wet, you know, wet shorts in the back of his truck and this and that. And he hated Chris and blah, 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 blah. All these reasons why he felt in his heart 25 years later, 30 years later, he was convinced that John Mark Byers killed those boys. But also through the course of that conversation, he was explaining to me where he was and when he was with John. You know, he took me to court. He dropped me off. He came back and then he picked me up and then we went home. And then when they got home, he described how they went and talked to his mom and his mom, you know, and Mark was like, I called him John. He goes by Mark or went by Mark. He's passed away now. That Mark was pissed.
Mm-hmm.
That Chris wasn't out cleaning the carport. And so where was it? And Ryan specifically remembered and recalled, witnessed his mom saying, I just looked outside. He was just out there in the carport. He's got to be. And they sent Ryan up to his room to look for him and all this stuff. So like he alibied Mark himself while telling me that he's certain that Mark did it. Because, you know, the thing was, like, Ryan didn't know the timeline. And then, like, from there on out, he was with Mark until, like, 9 o'clock at night. And, you know, I think he thought, well, maybe he went and killed him at 9 o'clock or whatever. You know, he didn't really know the timings, the timeline of when things happened. The point is, if Ryan were to go plea before the court,
I'm falling apart.
The point being that if Ryan were to go plea before the court, you know, if John Mark Byers had been convicted of this and he's appealing and all the evidence is out there, all this evidence I just described that clearly alibis him for the murder. No chance. It's not possible for him to have done it. But then Ryan says he hated Chris. I'm certain he did it. There was this, this, and this. And then the judge were to then ignore all that evidence of alibi and say, well, it doesn't matter because Ryan doesn't want him to get out because Ryan's convinced that he did it. Like it should, it can't be that way. It can't.
No, it makes sense. So this next one is from Ali and says, I'm concerned that since Adnan is maintaining his innocence and not apologizing or taking ownership of the crime, that it is going to be held against him in the judge's decision. Thoughts?
I have the same fear. I'm really, really concerned that this judge will rule to send him back to prison. And that's concerning because obviously he's been out and free for a couple of years now. I believe he's 100% innocent. He deserves to be out. But also, if he goes back in, I don't know if he'll ever get back out. I mean, there's a chance. There's a chance the defense could try to solidify the motion that Mosby filed, do a better job, fill all the holes in that Bates identified and try it again. But it's still pretty flimsy to overturn a conviction on. They've tried so many different things. So, yeah, I'm scared too. I'm just hoping and praying that doesn't happen. And that's all at this point. It's all we can do. Like the cards have been played. It just we got to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, Maureen says, I know there are some things that haven't been publicly shared, and likely some behind the scenes investigating. But is there anything else that can be done to encourage investigating alternate suspects?
You got to get at this point. All of us, the internet sleuths, for lack of a better term to call us, I think that we've investigated as much as we possibly can. At this point, it will take the Baltimore PD to actually engage and use subpoena power and do the work to actually investigate it. And that's just not going to happen unless this conviction gets overturned. Even if the judge rules that to resentence Adnan for time served and he's out and free for the rest of his life, as long as he is still convicted of this crime, no one is going to further investigate it. And that is a sad state of affairs from my perspective, which is that Adnan is innocent and the real killer is still out there.
And Maureen writes it as well. It says, if the JRA request is granted, I'm so worried the actual killer will never be brought to justice.
Yeah, exactly. That's there's so many sad parts about this, but that is definitely one of the biggest sad parts to me is I feel I tell you what, the thing, and I said it in the episode, it kind of got passed by, I think, by most people, but one of the most disappointing parts to me, if Bates is telling the truth, and we don't have any evidence or reason to believe he's not, in that executive summary, is that while Marilyn Mosby stood up in those press conferences and told us all that there is an active investigation happening right now to find out who killed Hay, and we've all been holding our breath, hoping that investigation was going to yield the results, and we were finally going to learn who actually killed her and bring real justice. And then he wrote in there that there never was investigation. Ugh. There was no evidence of her doing any investigating. The police department was not ordered to, nor did they do any investigating. None of that was true, according to Bates's motion. Nothing happened. She just,
sad.
Yeah, it appears that she just gathered enough information up that she could throw it into that motion to be the hero who got the conviction overturned, and never did any of the actual work, if what he said is to be believed. And that's the most disappointing part, because we had the opportunity. Like, we had the opportunity while she was in office, where she was motivated to solve this case, and she could have, and she didn't. Mm.
So our last question comes from Allison, and it's really not a question about this, but we're going to go from there. It says, thank you, Bob, for your objectivity and your optimism in regards to this episode this week. My question is for season 7. Will Bob's former student, who made the music for 16, also be doing the music for 17? The intro to 16 was a bop, as the kids say.
Yeah. I don't know yet. I haven't really thought that far ahead. I'm kind of thinking that the circumstances of the case are similar enough that I've been considering using the same, you know, just having Caden, you know, do some different VO work as far as the intro, maybe adding a couple more tracks, but still continuing with the same theme from that one, because I think it'll fit well into the new case. So I think that's probably what's going to happen. So in a way, yes, we'll still be using Caden's music.
Awesome.
for season 16 or 17, which hopefully is coming up soon. We have NDAs going back and forth now, getting stuff signed, as far as it's just a process that we have to go through with the lawyer. So essentially, so they can be completely open with us and know that we can have private conversations and everything they say doesn't end up on a podcast. That's what we're working through right now. And then hopefully very soon that we'll be coming out with that. And with that being said, we're going to go ahead and wrap this thing up on Sunday. This week, you're going to hear the episode that I was planning on doing. I mean, kind of the episode I was planning on doing next week. And so I'll let the cat out of the bag for you guys. It is a replay of an old episode for a reason. Somebody had mentioned this. It is way back from season 5. When I played the full audio of Jesse Miss Kelly's false confession, and I don't know, I think a lot of people are new since then and haven't heard it yet, but I played it all and broke it down piece by piece. So you actually get to hear the interview and then me breaking it down along the way as we go. I'm replaying it for a couple of reasons. One, I really want everybody to have a fresh and recent look at what false confessions look like. And I've also remastered it with some of the new software that we have. So it's the cleanest version of that interview anybody's ever heard.
Excellent.
When I was listening back through the old one, I was like, it's so hard to hear the interview because it's so bad. But now with the software we had, I did some work on it and it came out. It's like really crisp and clear. So it's much easier to hear. And hopefully we have that big news coming in the West Memphis 3 case. So it'd be great to refamiliarize ourselves with that as all this is happening. And so that's my plan for this week. Obviously, there's a bit of me talking an intro and talking about some things at the beginning. But then I think it's a good refresher for everybody. It's a crystal clear version of it, and give you guys an update and a refresh on how false confessions happen, because I think it's going to be relevant very soon. And with that being said, I'm going to wrap this thing up. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks, everybody, for being in the chat. And we'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.